I won't.
Now, I want the Pasuk Yirah. It says, Makor Chayim Pi Tzadik. The source of life is the mouth of the Tzadik. If you are Sham in the mouth of the wicked, Yichas Hachamah ties violence. So, what is the source of life? From the mouth of the righteous, you will get the source of life. That's how you get the source of life, from the mouth of the righteous. However, the mouth of the wicked hides violence. Really, it shouldn't say that it hides violence. Really, it should say that that is the opposite of the source of life. What does the one part have to do with the other? So that a human being's life is his decisions, how he makes decisions. That is the source of every area of his life. That is really what we're talking about, how you make decisions. What is the difference in the manner in which the mouth of the tzaddik makes decisions and how the wicked make decisions? For instance, if you take Mishlei, the way we've been learning Mishlei, you think back to all the pesukim that we've been learning, you see it's a very, very practical view of life. You have to look at life in a very practical way and make decisions based on reality. What is reality? Analyze it and see until you see what the truth is. Right? But however, the desire of the wicked is when he tries to make decisions, part of it is decision making is involved with denying that reality. In other words, he has to deny that reality. He tries to deny that reality. A child that doesn't do his work in school is going to deny that he has any consequences. If the consequences was real to him, he would have to do it. But he denies that I could get away with it. I could do it later. I could copy. He denies that there's any consequences. So he's totally involved with denying of reality. Well, for a human being to see the consequences and say, I do not want to do it. That's the question, right? Now, the answer is no, that's impossible. So you tell me that there are people that say, I know that I could get cancer from smoking, but I'm still going to smoke. The answer is they don't really see that they don't really believe that they're really going to get cancer. What they're really saying is, I accept what society says. I accept an authority that he says, the society, that they say that I'm going to get cancer. But it's not that I really accept that. My mind doesn't see it. If my mind actually saw it, then I'd have to, that the cancer, my mind saw it, I would not be able to smoke. But the thing is, the way I look at it, when I'm saying that I know I could get cancer, what I'm saying is society says I could get cancer, and I'm just saying what society is saying. What does it mean, Yichas Hachamah? It says he hides violence. That doesn't seem to be the way we're interpreting it. So if you look at the Ibn Ezra says that yes, Tireya v'lo yomad musa. He tries to deny. Tireya tries to destroy the knowledge, and he doesn't want to learn musa. Musa means the practical view of life. What we're doing there, how to live life correctly. So that's what the Ibn Ezra says. Okay. So the question is, so where's the violence here according to the Ibn Ezra, right? What I think it means is that we're talking about, if you want the source of life, it means how to really make decisions, then you should go to the Tzaddik. But if you listen to the wicked, if you listen to the Rasha, that's hiding violence. Why? Because he's going to tell you to have your immediate pleasure now. What he's hiding is the consequences that's going to occur if you listen to him. That's what he covers up. He covers up the violence, meaning the consequences of your actions, of your immediate actions. That he will definitely not point out to you. On the contrary, he'll just show you the immediate pleasure of what you could get now and how great it is, and he'll deny those consequences. And he'll help you deny. You will avoid thinking about it altogether. That is the violence that he cited. Consequences. Suma hatred to Orer Madonna. Thought fights and quarrels. Kol Peshoim, and on all faults, Techasa Ahava, love covers over. Question is one of these things, does one of them, it doesn't seem to point to the fact which one is better. Usually we talk about the Tzaddik and the Rasha, and so we know which side is good and which side is bad. But over here it doesn't say, it just says two simple facts. I mean, it says a fact that hatred awakens quarrels, and if somebody has a problem, the person that loves them will cover it up. Okay? So it's stating a fact, I mean, and it's not saying of, you know, whether one is good, whether there's consequences, whether there's no consequences. It's just stating a fact. So what do I need that for? What is he telling me? In the Torah Medonim, the Rabbah points out that the that when a person has hatred, even if there's, you don't do anything wrong, he finds fault where there is no fault. You see?
Mm-hmm.
If he finds fault where there is no fault, because of his hatred, he's going to start a quarrel over there. Mm-hmm. He's going to find fault where there is no. And love, wherever there are problems, he doesn't see any problems.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So what I think what he's saying is, or I think what the Pasuk is saying, is that any extreme emotion is a problem. Any extreme emotion. Because the thing is, with any extreme emotion, you can't see reality. Now, each one has a different problem. When you have hatred, you'll see faults where there aren't any. And when you have love, you will not see problems when you should see them, either to protect yourself or to help the person that you're with. So to say of your loved one, you can't even help them if you know you can't see it. So therefore, either way, any extreme emotion you can't make decisions this way. You should not make decisions based on emotions. That's what it's saying.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it would go back to the last pasuk. The last pasuk is telling you how to make decisions. So you should make decisions. One of the things is you should be very careful and not to make decisions based on your love or hate. Either one of those decisions is going to be a problem. So the question is, the question that we want to discuss here is God wanted to create a being that should have free will. Now the problem is that anytime God creates, what it means is he creates the nature of that being. So once you have the nature, how could you have free will? Like for instance, a tiger, a lion, a crocodile, any animal, its nature is creative. So therefore, once it's created, it must live according to that nature. Now, if God wants free will, so how is it possible he creates somebody with free will? Because once you create something, they already have a nature. And if they have a nature, they must live according to that nature. So therefore, what God did was he created a being with two natures. Okay, and the two natures is the emotions, right, in the human, the emotions, and the intellect and wisdom, right? Now, the thing is that emotions were created, the system of psychology is that it is a system to help the human being to see the world from an irrational point of view. And the other part of the human is a scientific view of life, a rational view of life. And that is the choices in which you have. That's why this Pasuk in Pasuk Yedrei says that both hatred and love make you see the world from an irrational point of view, where it's taken to an extreme, you see? In other words, it doesn't mean you shouldn't have love, but that shouldn't be the decision maker in your life. The decision maker in your life goes back to the last pasuk of Mechar Chayim Peace Tzaddik. It should be from wisdom. It doesn't mean you shouldn't have emotions. It just means that part of you shouldn't be the decision maker. But when you should have an outlet for your emotions, that should be decided by the mind to make sure there are no consequences. And so the sixth day another. In the mouth of the Navon, in the words of the Navon, Timotei Chachma, you'll find wisdom. The Shevet and a stick, and a stick, to the back of a person that lacks knowledge. Or four. Explanation is that an intelligent person will learn from knowledge. You'll teach him, he'll listen to the words of the wise,
mm-hmm.
and through his understanding, he'll see the truth, and he will change his ways based on knowledge. While a fool will only change his ways based on force, not by knowledge, but either sometimes a situation or somebody is forcing him, or whatever is forcing him, but not because he actually sees it. If he does the correct thing, not because his mind sees it, but that he is forced to do it. Point of learning the pasuk, and say that the words "sitzei navam," the words of the wise, should also be read as part of the second half of the pasuk. Therefore, it should be read that the lips of the navam, the intelligence, you'll find with them, and his words will be like a stick to the back of a fool. He lives the life of his own emotions, of how he feels. Now, what is the words of a navam? The words of a navam is truth and reality, right? Now, when he hears that truth and reality, it hurts him so much because it goes so much against how he lives. It's like a stick on his back. It's a distasteful thing when he hears reality, and it's so much against his emotions, he hates what the guy has to say. It's like a stick on his back. Gallup is also, again, two approaches, and you take both approaches. Okay, he says, Chachamim Yitzimudah, the wise hide their knowledge, and see a veil in the mouth of a fool is Mechita Karova, his destruction is close. Saying is that the mouth of the fool will bring destruction very quickly. He'll have be destroyed quickly from his mouth. Saying is that just because you have the truth doesn't mean you should always tell it. Okay, and that goes in two ways. Sometimes you have the truth, you have a fact. But that doesn't mean you should always tell it if you can harm somebody, right? But not only that, but even in wisdom, there's certain wisdom which there's certain people that are not on the level to accept. Either they can't accept it because it's too abstract, or they can't accept it because emotionally they're not ready for it, and sometimes have to be taught slowly until you could emotionally accept certain areas of knowledge. You have to go into the subject slowly. And so therefore you have to know. And also, the reason why you should be careful, you should not, if you think the person is going to misunderstand, you see, so there again, you could either harm the other person or yourself, they misunderstand, and then they'll come out against you.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is that when you have knowledge, you have to also be intelligent of how much and to whom you should divulge that knowledge to. However, the fool, here over here, when we're talking about a fool, we're talking about a person that has knowledge. He has real knowledge. But what he is lacking is the knowledge of when to divulge it and when not to divulge it. That is missing. And if he divulges it, either in one of the three ways, either where the other person is not ready to accept it because intellectually he's not ready to accept it, or emotionally he's not ready to accept it, or they'll misunderstand what he has to say. You see? Which is pretty close to where he's not ready intellectually. That's pretty close. But the thing is, so that would explain. Because people misunderstand what he has to say. Oh, how wise you are. So therefore, what you do is you try and show all your wisdom. And really, you should be discernful, be very careful, and the wisdom should only be given only to what the people are ready for. Learning in Chachamim Yitzchin Adar is that they, by hiding, it means that they make it a part of them. Hiding is like a metaphor, meaning that I make it a part of me, the knowledge, like a second nature. where he makes it like a second nature, where he reviews it and the idea becomes so clear and so much a part of him that it becomes like a second nature, and he thinks in that way. It's the way he thinks now. The knowledge is the way he thinks. That's what he means, Yitzchak. He holds on to it. Rashi and the Ibn Ezra both say that they hide it in such a way that they shouldn't forget it. They keep it, they go over it, that it should become like second nature, a part of it. That's what they mean. The second half of the process is talking about a person that studies and has knowledge. But the only thing is, he never made it second nature. And so therefore, mechita broken is supposed to be broken, meaning the knowledge will be lost. All his knowledge will be lost. I mean, like if you ask people how much they remember from college or from high school, a lot of people say, practically nothing. You say, how do you remember anything? I remember I one time knew somebody, he says he only remembers 4 months of the 4 years of college anyway. He says, well, because that teacher happened to have closed room discussions. They were very personal, so he remembered them.
Mm.
Knowledge is really your life. Mm. Even though there's a tremendous amount of knowledge, there is no obligation to finish. There are certain people that have the ability to study in depth, to make it a part of them, and to cover a tremendous amount of knowledge. These are the famous thinkers. But the regular people, so they should only go as fast as they could absorb, so they won't get all the knowledge, but the main thing is that they should absorb the knowledge and become a part of them, and not that they should have a lot of facts. Like somebody says that he's like a donkey carrying books. You know, so you only have a lot, either you have a lot of facts, or the facts are soon forgotten, either way, and it's of no value. That's why it says Chacham and Yitzchak Nidat, that they store it, they protect it, Rashi says. They protect it. And it becomes false. So therefore, a person should not be in a rush to move faster than he can absorb. Of a rich man is like Kiryas Uzo, a fortified city. It's like a fortified city. Mechitas Dalam. And what breaks the poor is resham, their poverty. In that he seems to be advocating wealth as some type of a value system. That it's a benefit, it's like a fortified city, it protects you. So the thing is, it seems to be advocating wealth. The Torah. And he says that money sometimes saves a person from his troubles, even though he is not a wise person. It means that there are certain situations that without knowledge are, in certain situations, are better off. In other words, if you have no knowledge, so then the rich are better off than the poor. Without wisdom, the rich do have an advantage over the poor. They have certain, if my car breaks down, I have to worry where I'm going to get the money to buy it. They just go out and buy a new car. It's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
They, in other words, and if there's money they need for doctors, that's it, they get the best. You see, so in certain cases, in many cases, like an army, that is like in the, what it says in the Pasuk here, like it's a fortified city. An army, two armies, not talking about good strategists, equal armies. And the person that has the better fortification or the number of soldiers will win over the other.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we're saying. Understood that with all the money, it makes no difference if you have a lot of money or poor if you are wise. Because the real protection from anything is wisdom. That's why the Ibn Ezra says that at times it can save you from trouble even though he's not wise. See, the ultimate protection in this world is wisdom. But according to the Ibn Ezra, the Pasuk is still saying there are certain situations without wisdom that one way is better than the other. Money is better than poor. is that the poor person and the rich person both have the same value system, that money is a value. So therefore, definitely, and they are right in a certain situation, but not totally, but that they lift the idea of money, since it could work in a few situations, they lift it to a very high level and universalize it in all areas. That is not fair. All areas, security in all areas, only comes from wisdom, only comes from compromise. If someone buys money to the help and is beneficial, and however the ultimate benefit is only chakra.
Yeah. We're up to verse 16 in chapter 10, okay? Says, Pula Tzadik Lachayim, the actions of the righteous are for life, and Tzvulas Rasha Lachatas, and the product of the wicked is for, Chatas literally means sin, but by sin here it means for failure, that it will fail. Okay? Now the question that I would like to ask is, there are two types of opposites. There's an opposite with a means, and there's an opposite without a means. There's an opposite with a means, like for instance, hot and cold. So then you have warmth. There's sharp and dull, there's no means. Or moves into non-movement, there's no means. Even moving into non-movement. Okay? Now, the verse over here seems to hold that there is either a good life or a terrible life. There is no in between. And the question is, maybe there's a better life. Can we show that this is true? And maybe there is a very good life, terrible life, and then something in between. Maybe we can show that there's something in between. Why does Shlomo HaMelech, why does King Solomon seem to take on the to accept the fact that that you either you lived a good life or you lived a bad life? There's no such thing as anything in between. One way or the other. That's the question. It's on the way towards a certain direction, it means they're not there. When a person is studying the true life and what is the best life, usually at that time he is not living the best life and he doesn't even have the correct motive. But if he didn't study, even motives, you have to study to find out what's the correct motive and how you get the correct motive. You can't just take an operation and implant the motive. And then that in itself, how to get the correct, what is the correct motive and how you go about making it a part of you. But when you're on the way to something, you can't say that's part way, but you're really not there. You're simply not there yet until you get there. It's only your means, like when a person is thirsty, why they finish the glass? Because through every thought, because why they continue is because they're still removing thirst. They stop the middle, they'd be thirsty. You see? So the thing is the same thing when you're going towards the best life, at that point you don't have the best life. But however, it's when you get there, it's sometimes, I'm not saying it's totally all or nothing, but there are parts that you better your life. But in that area then, in other words, like this, especially for instance, I have two pains. And I get to remove one pain, so it's not halfway, it's just that I remove one, but I still have the other. Two different pains. That's what I mean, that it's not an all or nothing. Now, there's movement that you might clear up one part, but there might be a few other parts that are not cleared up. But in the process of moving, you see, in the process of moving, there at that moment you're not there. So therefore, the problem is still, what is there a means, and can we prove Shlomo HaMelech that there is no means? In his introduction to the Ethics of the Fathers, talks about pleasure, and he says that the pleasure is like, well, let's use two terms here, okay? I use a Hebrew term called taiva and the English term pleasure, okay? And I'll define both my terms, okay? I'll define it in a few minutes, okay? So he's talking about taiva. Taiva is looked down upon. Pleasure is not looked down upon, okay? Now, he says a person that's involved in the world of Kaiva, which I will define, involved in the world of Kaiva, it's like a person that drinks and he becomes more thirsty with his drinking. I was thinking, like, for instance, soda, right? If you're thirsty, you drink all that sugar, now immediately the liquid makes you feel that you're satisfied. But then later you're more thirsty. And I understand that's also with milk, because milk is really not a liquid, it's a protein, even though it's in the form of a liquid, but actually when you drink it, it's really a protein. And even though immediately you might feel your thirst quenched, but in the long run it's not quenching your thirst. So the thing is that's what he is saying. He's saying that kaiva is like that, okay? That the more you have, the more you want, the less satisfied you are, okay? Now, but he did not say, he actually says that if you're thirsty. He does not mention, let's say, for instance, I feel like drinking a soda because I'm in the mood for taste, I feel like having like a dessert. If you're not thirsty. Well, then, of course, you just drink enough to satisfy taste. It's not going to awaken. But if it does awaken a thirst for it, then you know you went too far. Fine, then it becomes a thirst. But many times, you can have a soda or an ice cream, and it's just a taste, and it's not because of you're thirsty, okay? So, kaiva is a thing which is a desire, which by nature, okay, when you go for it, you satisfy yourself immediately for a short term, but then the desire is awakened even more. And every time you're successful in that pleasure, the desire is awakened to a higher degree. Okay? And therefore, and you're not satisfied. Okay? So the thing is that's kaiva. That's the power of the game. However, pleasure, if you enjoy a pleasure, on the contrary, you shouldn't give it up. You should enjoy it. There's nothing wrong with enjoying the physical world. But what we're against is where you're destroying yourself. And we'd like to show exactly how kaiva works and what is kaiva. Okay? About kaiva is that it is a desire for something, and the nature of that desire is such that the more you have it, the more you'll need it, and the less satisfied you'll be. Like an addiction, exactly. Exactly like an addiction. The more you have, the worse it gets. I'd like to take the illustration of success. A person who goes into business, who wants to be a successful person, the desire is not a practical thing. In other words, if it's practical, you go into business, you want to be successful, they're practical things. You want a nice home, you want a nice family, you want a nice, comfortable thing, fine. But then you'll notice there's a lot of people that start out that way, but then somehow the family becomes secondary, and the making of money becomes primary. And it's not for the purpose of a practical thing. Money is a practical thing, and it's nice to have money and savings and comfortable and security. That we're not against. But the only, even if you become wealthy, we're not against that. But if the drive for the money is the money for success, it's just to accumulate money, so then that type of success, we say, is what we're talking about. Then we'll call it kaiva. At that point, we'll call it kaiva. So if you make money and you feel comfortable and you feel good about yourself, that's go for it. That's a good life. The thing will help you work that out as much as you can. But if you start going for success itself, where success itself becomes a value, then we say you're destroying yourself. Okay? And that's what we like to say. Okay. Success is really a comparative thing. In other words, if you were living on one of the islands, you know, then how much coconut you have will be how much successful you are. You would not think in terms of money or big buildings even. You know what I mean? And the what success there is different than here. So it's just a comparative thing, what success is, right? Comparisons are something else. So that means success has to come only with comparison to somebody else. Now, I'll ask you, when is the first time in your life that you recognize success? Who is the first person? You probably have to go back to some place 2 or 3 years old
and you suddenly realize the parents, and you looked at them and you said, wow, they, in other words, you're this little wimp that you can hardly do anything on your own, and here you see these big giants walking around, and they can do anything, and they're in control, and they're the successful ones, and you want to be like them, right?
Okay.
Is that correct?
Okay.
Now the question is, when that child thought of that, at that moment, when that child first recognized that, what feeling, child doesn't know, we're trying to analyze, we're trying to know what the child felt. What feeling did the child feel? Only what he felt, no interpretation. Not how he interprets you, but what is the feeling? What do you think? Say, we could use the word jealous. I say, he wants to be like his parents. He wants to be like them, right? So then in his mind, what is his definition of success? Right. And therefore, what would make him successful? No. That's not what he feels. That's an interpretation. What's his definition of success at this point?
Equality.
Not equality. That's a new idea. Only from the idea that we have right now.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that he knows is success is that when somebody wants to be like you, that is success. That's the only thing he saw. I want to be like them. That is success. That's the emotion he felt. That has to be the first emotion. So therefore, success to him is when somebody wants to be like you.
Success is an infantile view of life where you want people literally to be jealous of you, to envy you, and to want to be like you.
Is that so? We'll say, okay, fine, it's a crazy type of pleasure, but that's the human, that's his desire to make people like him. So, but he can be successful, he'll get people to be jealous of him. Yeah, fine. But the only thing is why can't he be satisfied? You see? True, it sounds terrible, but once we define it, it sounds like a mess. But the fact is, we still have to ask the question. So, but why can I never, ever be satisfied? What's the problem? I can be satisfied. I'll make other people envious of me and see I'm successful. So that's the way I do it. So why would I, like Maimonides says, that I'll constantly dream means I'll constantly work for success and I will be successful and I'll become more thirsty. I'll be driven to more thirst. Why is that? That's in your time, or you're the best in your neighborhood, you don't look around or among your group, then there's always the best, or you start thinking you're the best, whatever, how you work it out, with different emotions. Let's say, for instance, you have a desire for ice cream, okay? Now, usually when you have a desire for ice cream, you like a cup of ice cream, right? Let's say you have a desire for ice cream, you give you one bite. One bite, let's just take it away. What would happen? After you had the first bite, would it be greater than the desire before or after? After you taste it, the desire would be much greater. So therefore, when you taste something, but you only get a partial satisfaction, you have to say that desire is awakened more. Right? Now, if we could see how success, by its very nature, only satisfies you partially. It could never, ever satisfy you completely. People, when they're wealthy or successful, politicians, that they're never really satisfied. There are many, many illustrations. But the only thing is, I think that if you see precisely wrong, see, then you can always say, well, it happened to them, it won't happen to me. There's always that argument, you know? It happens to them, not to me. But if I think if we could answer this question and show precisely why, that in the nature of Kaiser, it must be that you cannot be satisfied if your mind actually sees it, then I think that then naturally you will you can't go there. Like the first time, like when you were burnt by fire, that's it. If you really got burnt,
you can't go there. If somebody tells you not to go there, well, maybe, you know, maybe believe them, but, you know. But the thing is that I think that we still, with all the illustrations, I think that we still have to keep it exactly why, that the more you have, it's exactly like an avid desire for ice cream. You just take one bite, that, and then it doesn't, you're not, it's not that you're satisfied. It's just that the desire is awakened to a much greater level. And that's it. And that the nature of this these pleasures are that when you get them, then it's going to be greater. The desire will be greater. And you can't be satisfied because it will never totally satisfy you. And therefore, the more you drink, the more thirsty you'll get. What is, we have to define precisely what is the pleasure of getting somebody to envy me. Okay? Now, I am not experiencing anything. What I'm doing is interpreting how you view me. And based on my interpretation, I feel good. Okay? Based on, like, for instance, well, in this case, let's get to this case. We'll give other illustrations later. But in this case, I mean, it's simply that you're, and well, let's put it this way. Let's say we both touch the table. And we both know exactly how the table feels. Now, because I touch the table and I know how it feels, I can interpret how you feel. But I can't feel your experience. Right? I can't feel your experience. That's about it. I can only interpret your experience. So let's say, for instance, an actor would get up and do a great job, and they're really clapping. They're really happy. Now, all he hears is the clapping. He's not experiencing how they felt during the play. Right? That he doesn't know. He only sees the result of that emotion. So therefore, he interprets that they would like to be me. You see? So it's an interpretation. Okay? Now, which is more satisfying to the emotion? An interpretation of pleasure or a feeling of pleasure? You see? If it's only based on your interpretation, it's really not totally satisfying. It can't be. Because you're not experiencing anything. What are you experiencing? Is any physical thing you're experiencing? It's based totally on your understanding. But let's say, for instance, I enjoy ice cream. I enjoy talking with my wife. I enjoy socializing. It's a positive thing. I really experience a certain enjoyment. But if my enjoyment is dependent on interpreting how the other person feels about me, you see, then it's not as satisfying. So therefore, it's like having ice cream, a bite of ice cream, and not really satisfying yourself. A different area. There is a certain time that when a fire is going, suddenly you get caught up and you just stare at it. Some people tell me they stare at it for like an hour. Some people 10 minutes. So they just get caught up in staring at the fire. Now the question is, they say this, that they enjoy it. I say, yeah, but what is the nature of that enjoyment? What is the nature of that enjoyment? They're just standing there staring at a fire. You know, you just transfixed. Okay? The answer is that you're really caught between two opposite emotions. Fire for the emotions draw a person, draws you towards it. There's something about it that draws you towards it. But simultaneously, the fear is getting burnt. So you're stuck between two, you're caught between two emotions. So what you're getting is you're just caught between. You can't tell me that's satisfying. You're caught where you can't move between two emotions. You can't tell me that's satisfying. Now I'm saying the same thing here. The nature of the satisfaction of success is not that you caught between two emotions, but the nature of the satisfaction is such that it cannot be totally satisfying. And just like you agree that when you have a desire and you only partially satisfy it, the desire will be much greater than when you began, I say the same thing here. Since by nature can't be totally satisfied, why can't you be totally satisfied? Because the thing is, you're not experiencing anything. You're not experiencing anything. It's just your interpretation. It could be a true fact. I'm not even talking about where you believe people like you when really they don't. They're talking behind your back. We're not even talking about that. I'm talking about where it's a true interpretation. That's definitely no satisfaction. But the thing is where, even if it's a true interpretation, that people really do envy you. But the thing is, it's still based not on my experience. I'm not experiencing their feelings. I'm interpreting how they feel about me. That's what satisfies me. That is not consistent. There's nothing you could do about it. In other words, if you really have this desire, I say the only thing that you could do about it is see these ideas. Until these ideas become so real to you, then suddenly you feel like the pleasure just naturally falls by the wayside. This type of thing called taiva, not pleasure. Right? Taiva, I mean, in other words, where so you're drawn to something that's not really satisfying. Okay? So the thing is that whenever you're drawn to that type of thing, so the thing is if you start analyzing and thinking it through again and again, and through the different system in Mishle and through other areas of discussion in the ethics, the ideas come up again from different angles and from different ways and different... I'll soon show you another type of fantasy, how again it's not totally satisfying from a different angle, the same idea from a different angle. But the thing is, it's again and again and again, it starts becoming more... See, because this is not just an idea. The idea, you have to experience the emotion, it has to become real to the emotion. If it's only real to the mind, you feel every step that I said, you see it. Well, yeah, that's nice, you know. But it's not going to change when you walk out of here, you're the same human being. But after months and years of again seeing these ideas, it starts affecting your emotions, and then you start working in a different framework. And this very knowledge, these very discussions are changing you. That's all that changes you. There is nothing else, in my opinion, that changes anybody except this change of view. In fact, in Torah, we do not have the word philosophy. We have the word hashkafa. Hashkafa means a viewpoint. You see? We look at it that we must change your view of life, you see? And from hundreds or thousands of different angles, you start seeing that the life of Taiva, of this fantasy life, really a fantasy type of life, it's not that there is that we have a greater pleasure than them, but they are totally tormented, they're being driven by something that what every time they're successful, it doesn't satisfy them and make their desire greater. Which is pain. Desire. I mean, to be have desire without any satisfaction is a catastrophe.
But by just knowing this
knowledge, but the knowledge will not change you today. You will not walk out of here a new person. But it's again and again and again and again and again, slowly but surely. Suddenly one day you'll be walking around, suddenly you start thinking differently. You'll look at things differently. You relate to things differently. A slight difference you'll notice. You see? That's when then you'll know that it's affecting you. But there is nothing to do. It's not like the laws of the Torah. The laws of the Torah are obligated to act upon, whether we like it or not, whether we enjoy it, whether we hate it. And there's a lot of commandments, and many times it's a big pain. Very difficult. We're obligated to do, obligated to obey it, whether we like it or not. But the thing is, this part of Torah can only come, you can't force yourself. It has to come naturally as a result of your knowledge.
And are we interested?
One idea that is not clear will not affect yourself equal to one idea, equal to one idea that is totally clear. That affects your soul the most. And therefore, that's why I have to have this type of class where we sit down and talk about and answer all your questions until it's clear to the mind. Because that is the only thing that truly affects your soul. How is it that this knowledge, in and of itself, how does it affect the soul? That's the question. Right. Human being is made up of two parts. What is the emotions and instincts and emotions on one side, and we also have a soul that helps us see truth and reality, both sides. Okay? Now, the thing is that there is such a thing called rationalization, right? People rationalize their actions in the everyday life, right? All right? Whatever we do, we see as being good and right. And even Hitler saw that what he was doing was right. He was doing it for the German people, and for their benefit, he saw it as being right. Every human being has to see that they are right in their own eyes. Okay? Now, why is that? Because the thing is that if they saw the truth, then they couldn't live against it. That's why. So therefore, they have to see this as being the truth. Okay? We didn't prove anything. I'm just trying to show. I'm just trying to show that that's where the idea of rationalizing comes about. They rationalize their actions. You have to be careful. When a person is rational and his actions are a result of his rationale, that's not a... When a person is rational and his actions are a result of his rationale, that's not rationalization. That is a rational person working out what is the best one. When a person doesn't act right or wrong and then he brings an argument why it's right, that's rationalization. You see? It has nothing to do with reality. It's just a matter of making himself right. You see? And making himself correct. But it's impossible. I say the reason why this is so. But it is impossible for the person to see the truth and not live it. It's impossible. that the reason for this is because for next time to do is to show another angle for what the Maimonides says, that the person desires the tithing and it gets worse. The desire becomes great and he's not satisfied. When we were talking about success, we started out to show where the first time, the first feeling of success was that the child feels that that is for, he looks at his parents and says, I would like to be like them. Right? That was the first feeling. Okay? Now, once that feeling is awakened, so when you are driving for success, right now, when you are driving for success based on that emotion, what are you trying to satisfy yourself now, or are you really not living in the present, but in a different time and a different place? I'll give you an illustration. Let me think of a different illustration. Let's say, for instance, the guy was in the war, right, in Vietnam, okay? Then he comes back to America, and he hears an airplane go, and he jumps to the ground, right? Now, when he jumps to the ground, why is that? Because at this moment, he's not living in America. He's making the decision right now to jump on the floor based on a totally different situation at different times. As if he's back in Vietnam, and the plane means that his life is in danger. So it's in a different place in a different time. It has nothing to do with the present. He's not making a decision about present life. Okay? Now, when this feeling, the first feeling, this infantile feeling, that I want to be like you, when you, let's put it this way, when you first started trying to answer what does the child see, well, the child sees this quality of the parent, that quality of the parent, the other different quality. Might be he did or he didn't, but that's not what he felt. What he felt was, I want to be like that, you see? But the thing is, you're already interpreting, you see? That's good, right? But however, the emotions are still back to that two-year-old or three-year-old desiring to be like the parent. That's the first time the emotion is awakened, and then you keep living in that desire, right? In other words, in the situation that desire was awakened, the way you saw life, I'm a little nothing, right? And my parents are adults. But now you're the adult, but that emotion is still there. So the truth is, the emotion shouldn't be there in this present time. Look, I'm out making a living, I have a child that's dependent on me, and I'm an adult, and I'm everything, right? But so why should I still be running after that to be like others? That infantile desire is at a different time. Like a person, let's say, for instance, you had a good time at some time. Then you like to think it over. Now, which is the greater pleasure? Which is more satisfying? The actual situation or the memory? Yes, I know, that's what pictures, I know. We have to go with that to fantasy. I mean, that you realize that's also not satisfying. Mm. It's a not satisfying, whatever that desire is, that's a non-satisfying desire again, you see? But the thing is, what I'm trying to show you that I can't say all, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm tempted to say all. I would say that most of the fantasies and most of the things that we call type or fantasy is because you're really enjoying not just the present, but you're really enjoying a different time and a different place, different situation. And that's where the emotions are stuck. At a different time, you see? And since it is a different time, it can, in a different place that you're trying to satisfy, it's impossible to be totally satisfied. In other words, like this. If you have a daydream that you want to have something, right? And I ask you, which would you prefer, daydreaming about it or having it? You would definitely say having it, right? But now you are trying to get something that doesn't exist anymore. It simply doesn't exist. You're not a 2 or 3-year-old anymore. That situation when you wanted to be like that adult and to feel, you know, that you could do everything, doesn't exist. In fact, your interpretation of your parents don't exist. And when you're 10 years old, you suddenly see your parents are human. Before that, you didn't see your parents as human. And you know, when I told this idea over the kids, she said, yeah, I remember the first time I realized my parents could get hurt or this or that. They start telling me, well, these crazies would have gone crazy. Because they, we really look at our parents as a totally different situation. And that is the source of all the prizes and all our fantasies. You think? So therefore, since it's a different time, a different place, so you can't enjoy it. No real enjoyment. The real enjoyment is taste. You know, social life, you like socializing, if you know, certain things that you really, but if it's dependent, in some ways it's not easy to tell, but if it's dependent on the, what the other person thinks, that was the first way, but if it's dependent on the past, you see, then it is not satisfying, and those are the type of things that you're drawn to. Okay? I'd like to go, okay, is that clear? Any questions? I'd like to take this one more step. You'll notice that one of the biggest areas that no matter how much you do, you're never satisfied, and yet you're always drawn to, is gossip. Okay, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're practically never, ever satisfied. No matter how much gossip, you can go for hours, you're never satisfied. So it must be, and this is from all the prizes that I've seen, from all these fantasies that I've seen, I've never seen anything like gossip. I mean, the quantity, I mean, it goes on. There must be something really lacking there in satisfaction more than anything else that draws people to such a quantity of it. It's like the best illustration. It's not that you had a spoonful of ice cream, but that we injected a taste of ice cream without having the ice cream, but it stays in your mouth all your life. You know what I mean? You never be satisfied. That's what gossip looks like, because you never get that. That's what it's like. The question is, why is it so? Okay? The question is what is gossip? What is gossip? Really, the real truth is, if you stop and think about all gossip, very rare is gossip talking nice about another person. It's about to destroy another person. So it comes from the desire to destroy, okay? But however, I mean, right, is that correct? Is that it? But the only thing is, when we talk about that person, we do not see the suffering of the person, okay? But we're cowards. We don't like to see that. You know, we couldn't see, we couldn't take a knife and stick it into a person, watch the blood. We might desire to do that, but we couldn't do it. So what we do is we talk about the person, right, to bypass our guilt. Because I don't see the person. Let's say, for instance, if I told you, as a result of your gossip, this person committed suicide. Or as a result of your gossip, this person was crying for 3 days straight. And you would be sick. Be absolutely sick. But the truth is, since your gossip was trying to destroy you, should be very happy.
Mm-hmm.
You see? But the truth is, you can't be happy because you have the guilt. See? The person that doesn't have the guilt is usually a will do it physically, okay? But the thing is, if the guilt is too strong, so then you have to gossip. So therefore, and if you want to gossip, then you don't want to see that you're being vicious, okay? Let's take the extreme case, okay? What is the enjoyment of the sadist? What is the enjoyment of the sadist? To see somebody else suffer, right? Okay. Now, the only thing is, does he experience the other person suffering? No. So the first thing is that it's your interpretation of what's going through, and you don't want to experience it. But since you experience some pain in your life, so therefore you can imagine what he is feeling at that time. And that's what you enjoy. So the first thing is that when you try to hurt somebody, and you enjoy hurting somebody, the pleasure is of the secondary kind, you can only interpret, your pleasure is based on an interpretation of another person. Right? That's the first thing about gossip. And the second thing about gossip, you can't even accept the enjoyment that you destroyed somebody. Because if you found out that you were actually successful, you feel too guilty. So therefore, it's even less pleasure because you can't admit that you're a vicious person. Nobody would admit that you're vicious just because you gossip. No person would gossip and say, well, my desire is I want to destroy this person. I'm very successful. I'm very happy. I never heard that from a gossiper. Never. Because a gossiper, that's the reason why they gossip, because they don't want to see how vicious they are. There's nothing wrong. I didn't do anything. All I'm doing is talking. You see? So they have that rationalization. You
anything. So therefore, it's even less satisfying than anything else. Because one is it's based on your interpretation, and two is that you can't even accept the interpretation. So therefore, it's like ingesting you with a taste of ice cream for your whole life and you can't get rid of it. That's why gossip, you're never really satisfied. And that explains the pasuk, that there is no in-between. Either you have the life of Torah, in other words, the life where you really analyze what is a real pleasure and what is really the true ideas, and you live according to that, or you're going to live in the fantasy world. And then you'll be caught up in pleasures that not only are they not satisfying, but they just awaken the desire, and there's no satisfaction. It's worse than drinking soda. 17, and the verse says that the way of life is to keep mussar. I'll explain what that means in a minute. And to leave telchacha is an error, will cause you to err. Okay? Now we have to explain what mussar is, the word mussar, and the word telchacha. Loosely translated, I believe they translated rebuke.
Mussar?
Yeah, isn't that how they translate it? Mussar is, there are two things to mussar. There's two parts. What telchacha? Sometimes the word telchacha is used. And that is, it is a science of life. That's how it's used in one way. We're just studying the science of life. And two, you also apply mussar when it's applied to yourself. Okay? In other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, I study physics. So then there's the science of physics. Now, if I build a car based on the physics, then that's the application of physics. Now, mussar is two things. It's the study of life. Now, here, by definition, if you don't use it, you're crazy. If it's the science of life, and that means it's going to give you the best life, so then definitely you should apply it too. So it's two parts. So therefore, he says that Orach L'Chaim, the way of life, in other words, the best life that a person could have, is if he learns the science of life and he keeps it. Shomer, he keeps it, he protects it, he guards it. Means that he makes it a part of himself and lives according to it. But if somebody leaves Telchacha, which is also equal to the word Musa, right, then Musa he'll live a life of failure. Okay? I think it's a very general pasuk. Pasuk is very universal. And all the other parts of Mishlei are details to this pasuk. In a way. In other words, many times we'll have a pasuk, a verse that's very universal. And sometimes he has it less universal, more particular. But this is a very universal thing that you must have the science of life, which is really what Mishlei is all about, that is the science of life. Same verse, according to the commentary of the Ibn Ezra. The first commentary is practically all the commentaries learn it the way we said it the first time. Ibn Ezra learns this verse slightly different. Says, Orach L'Chaim, the way of life, comma. Put the comma, okay? The way of life, to have a good way of life, you need two things. You have to guard Musa, that's the number, right? And you have to leave the false or the Musa that is an error. In other words, a good life, the first way we look at it is that if you want to have the good life, you've got to keep Musa. If you don't keep the Musa or Telchacha, then you're going to err. He says, no, to have a good life, you must be able to do two things. One is you must keep Musa, but you must also leave the Telchacha Musa, that Musa, which is an error. Okay? Let me save me. You think, I mean, forget about the, besides all the authors that write about life, every parent and every teacher is telling you about life. Everybody. And you pick up things you don't even notice what you're picking up. And if you're not very careful, you pick up things about life that are in error. Everybody knows what life is. Without thinking about it, everybody will tell you what to do, you know. If you go out without a coat, you're going to catch a cold. I mean, everybody knows that. Well, first of all, I don't know if it's true. Today, the new theory is basically you get a germ. That's nothing to do with your cold. So the thing is that, you see what I'm trying to say, is people make universal statements. Everybody accepts it, and they tell you about life. Over a cup of coffee, you'll have the greatest psychologists and philosophers talking all the time. But of what you pick up about life, then you'll have a false view of life and a false, very bad view of life. Because to be successful about life, you must know the positive, the science of life that you get through Torah. But simultaneously, you must be very careful to pick up the advice that people, everybody gives advice. Everybody knows what life is. Every parent, every teacher gives advice. Friends give advice. Everybody knows what seems to know what life is. He says, and therefore you have to be very, very careful to be aware not to accept a false view of life. Okay? And the next question that we have to ask is how could we protect ourselves against this false view? Is it possible for a human being to live the perfect life, to live the life that he knows the science of life, and then to be able to actually live according to that life without any errors? Okay? That's the question. Isn't such a thing possible? I say the answer is yes, it is possible, but not to everybody. It's possible for rare few people. That level of perfection, I think it has to be for a person that has the ability to be able to, not everybody has the ability to change their life to that extent. But I say practically everybody, or let's put it this way, I say most people, has the ability to change their life somewhat. Okay? Now, so the thing is that the question is how do I go about doing it, and how do I know how much I could change? Okay? Right. So I say that the only way that a person changes is only based on ideas. Okay? Like, for instance, I've had many discussion classes. I have in the high school classes a discussion. I have a weekend class of women, a class of women that we meet once a week. And we just have simple discussions. They don't work on it much more than them. They get a little bit. Some other time they might be discussing outside, they might talk about it. And yet everyone has told me, just based on the discussion, without much force and without any pressure from me at all, I don't bother after the discussion. I mean, what you're doing, the person wants, I'm not going to get involved in. But the thing is, everybody told me that they view life differently after the discussion, they act differently, they make decisions differently. Perfect? No, they're not perfect. But however, there is a development. Whether you have the ability to reach that perfection, you don't know. Don't say you that can't. You don't know. But however, you can go to a large degree to have a much better life because of the correct decisions that you'll start making. And a lot of pain, a lot of conflict that we have is sometimes just our view of life. We changed our view of life, we won't have so much conflict. These discussions help change the view of life, and these discussions will help you make decisions differently. So therefore I say, it's only academic whether you could or you can't. All you have to do is study the ideas and understand the ideas and to review the ideas or to have discussions with others. The more you go over it, becomes clearer to you, of course. But it's just the ideas itself. It's only how clear the ideas to you that it affects your very view of life. That's what we mean, that it'll affect your soul. Once the idea is clear in your mind, you haven't set the scene, then it affects your soul. And slowly but surely, as you go through the different schools, not one puzzle, not one verse, but the different aspects, and you start learning to view life in a different way and to make decisions in a different way. You don't even have to remember this or that subject. You have to remember it is better. But the main thing is how it affects how you view life and how you make your decisions. That's what's necessary. Tom Lloyd, how to become a general. Okay? He tells you, he says what you should do is you should read all the battles and all the plans and why they went right or why they went wrong and to know it and to analyze it. He says not to remember this or that battle. That's not the purpose. But the nature of strategy in war becomes second nature, and that's the way you think. It becomes second nature that you think that way. So then when you're planning a battle, all that knowledge, you see, is second nature to you, so then you immediately know how to analyze and think about it. That's exactly what we're saying here. Or a fact or a knowledge. But if it's a training of thinking, of the thinking in a certain way, so then the only training you can have is think in that area and read the greats in that area and the different ideas. And if somebody makes a mistake, see what the mistakes are so you could learn to avoid it. But then naturally you will think of these things when your situation in your life come about. You will naturally think about it, or you'll know how to think about it, or at least you'll know that there's something to think about. Which a lot of people don't even realize. You say, man, there's something to think about. There is a view of life, of the perfect life, but the only thing is that perfect life has nothing to do with reality. There's a demand upon you, which is impossible. Like, for instance, in the church, they have where a priest does not get married. Now, I say that's impossible. That's impossible to abstain. And you see today, I mean, it's coming out what's happening, right? It's an impossibility. So therefore, if you have such a view of reality, then it's not even worth trying. That is not even worth trying because it's not in reality. And you're trying to do something which is not in human nature, which we said before that it's very important for a person to know human nature, to know what you could demand of yourself. If you don't know human nature, then of course either you're going to demand too much or you're going to demand too little. You see? So then I say that you're right. That is not even worth trying for. That you shouldn't even try for because it's not in reality. Okay? But however, let's say we say that it is possible certain things that we could show clearly in human nature that it is possible, but it's just that you are not there yet. Then we will show, what we'll do is we'll show you methods of how you can get there. We won't guarantee that you will get there. There's no guarantee because, again, there's certain parts of a person that they have the ability to reroute their energy to a new direction. Some people don't have that much ability. It's only rerouted a certain amount. So the thing is that we are not asking you to be perfect. But what we are asking is that you study what perfection is and what the best life is in reality. And that knowledge, as you study it, will slowly get your direction to go in the correct direction. How far you go is your own ability. We can't say you will reach it. I say certain people have the ability to reach it. They will be the great. There are other people that could do a certain amount. And they could reroute a certain amount of their emotions from the evil way to the good way. And even what is evil? A lot of people have a false view of what evil is and what good is. So the thing is the false view you should even try for. But however, the true view, that should not be forced, but should only be through knowledge. The knowledge itself will guide you in the right direction. However, you have to be careful here. I'm not talking about actions. Actions, even if, like, for instance, first of all, the law that you're obligated to keep, that you're obligated to. You've got to force yourself. Just like if you're playing ball and the ball goes into the street, you should stop and look both ways, even though you might lose the game. But the thing is, and you don't want to do it, that you should force yourself for an action. To protect yourself, you have to force yourself. But however, insofar as your view of life and how much emotions you can get in line with the truth, that is a natural process of just by virtue of your understanding the truth. Nothing else. Sin is used in two ways. One is insofar as halacha is concerned, insofar as law is concerned, sin is just defined by either you're doing the act or you're not doing the act. You're doing that the correct, you're doing it correctly or incorrectly. Insofar as philosophy is concerned, it's slightly different, okay? Like, let's say, for instance, a great man one time said that an evil person, a righteous person, sorry, a righteous person is he that desires that which the evil person does. He dreams about that which the evil person does. Which means that a righteous person is a person that lives according to this idea. A righteous person is a person that lives correctly even though he still has the old emotions. You see? Now the thing is, you can undo the old emotions only through knowledge. Undo the emotions that stop you from living the correct life or causes you to live an evil life, the only way you can undo that is through knowledge. You see? But insofar as an action is concerned, that you're obligated to do the correct action. If you cannot do the correct action because of a certain emotion that's stopping you from doing the correct action, then you'll have to live with doing the correct action and then through knowledge to slowly try to undo the emotion so that you'll be able to do the correct action. If it's impossible for you to do the correct action. Up to somebody, right? Now when you have jealousy, there's one or two ways of undoing your jealousy. Either you buy a bigger house than the other person, or you destroy the other person's house. You don't have to buy a bigger house, right? That's what the evil person will do. Now, a good person might have jealousy and he'll say, oh, I wish that guy, his house would burn down, you know? But he won't burn it down. And he would be crazy to spend his life in competition just to build a bigger house because he knows there's better things to do. He doesn't really enjoy the bigger house. He has all of his physical and emotional needs satisfied. So with the jealousy, he just won't give in. Now the question is, if it's bothering him so much, then through understanding the knowledge, he'll have to undo the emotion. But he is a righteous person as long as he doesn't carry out the dictate of his jealousy. In Yom Kippur, we have different prayers about our wrong views of God and wrong views of what is right and what is wrong. Okay. There are two views of right and wrong. One is rationally, which we have proven, that which is right and wrong, you see. And then there's our emotional feelings. Let's take the story of Job. Everybody know the story of Job? Okay? Now here's a man that at the beginning of the book, the Torah testifies that this man was a very, very good-hearted and God-fearing person. The Torah testifies to this. And yet this man curses the day he was born and wishes he was never born, and he has questions against God. Terrible, terrible questions against God. You see? Now the thing is, this man knew who God was, but his emotions are not in line with it. You see? Now, in a certain situation, you have to understand, the emotion takes over totally. Now, as long as he's just questioning God and trying to understand how God is operating, where God's justice is, even with all his emotions and everything, he hasn't done anything wrong. He's just questioning. It's a search. And here the search is not guided by, we're sitting down, let's just analyze it. But it's guided by very, very powerful emotions where you feel that God is not relating to you correctly. And there's a terrible, terrible anger against God and something bad happened. And he had to work it out. And so in that situation, he was forced to work it out, what is the rational way. That's where the emotion interferes with your truth and your reality. But if the emotion is not interfering, and yet you have the emotion, so then you just realize that, well, I have this emotion, but I'm acting correctly. But you have to know, if you do have the emotion, there can be a situation that could take over. But slowly but surely, you move away from the emotion. But you are still a righteous person, even if you have these emotions. But you see the ideas correctly. You see the truth, color ideas with your mind. You study them, you analyze them, and you know the truth. Right? You know the truth. But however, you have emotions. In other words, you see with your mind the evil of jealousy, yet you still feel jealous. So if you act on it, then you're evil. But if you don't act on it, then you're not. Before, what you're asking, when we condemn a person for having the wrong ideas, it's because logically he has the wrong ideas. In other words, if I were to ask you, who is God? What could you know about God? If you have a certain feeling about God, well, that's not the true idea. True idea, you have to sit down and study the idea of God. You have to know that idea. There are 13 basic principles of faith that we have. Those are the basic ideas. Now, if you don't understand this clearly, so then you don't have the correct view of God. That's right.
That's where ideas are sin.
Well, you have the wrong view of God. You don't have the correct view of God. That's what we talk about ideas of sin. But let's say, for instance, I do have the correct view of God, but emotion comes in one day. I need all these commandments. I can't do this and I can't do that. One day it bothers me. So it bothers me, fine. There's nothing wrong. If it bothers me, I'm upset with it, fine. I have emotions, it's wrong. But I know the truth, I'm not going to act on those emotions. If I act on those emotions, then I'm evil. If I don't act on those emotions, so I have evil emotions, but I'm not evil. I read through the Torah, okay? And the Torah talks about the hand of God, God's vengeance, right? And let's say I take this all literally. There's a great big hand, thunder, or whatever it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now that's the wrong view of God. That's incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
To have a wrong view of God, that's really what we would consider idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Consider there is a physical being that has power, like a Superman, like a comet, right? That is the wrong view of God. You see? So that's what it means by a wrong view, that I have the wrong view. It takes many, many years to undo emotion and to have the emotions in line with the correct feelings. And some people can't do it. It's not possible for everybody. So that is not considered a righteous, or in other words, righteousness is where my mind has the correct ideas and I live according to those ideas. But if my emotions is not in line with it, I am not evil. That is not evil. Okay? So that's what I say. Correct ideas.
Okay.
I have the correct idea of God. I know the 13 animamans, the 13 basic statements of faith.
Mm-hmm.
I have a clear idea. I know who God is and what God is not. And I live according to these ideas. I obey the Torah and all my studies. I live the correct way, right?
Mm-hmm.
But however, my emotions don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Not too happy with it. The reasons why I want to do other things, and sometimes I don't feel like that keeping the law, right? Like if I have to eat kosher, right? Well, sometimes I'm on a trip, it'd be nice to go to McDonald's and get a cheeseburger, you know what I mean? I can't, you see? So the thing is, it's rough, I'm not getting upset. But that doesn't make me evil. But if I would go in and get it, because I'm really hungry and I haven't eaten for a full day, and it's not that I'm dying, but I'm really hungry, and I give in, that would be wrong. Well, I'm sorry, I have to control myself. You see? That would be wrong. But that I have the desire to go in, that's nothing wrong, as long as I don't live by it. Of course, the highest level of righteousness, you wouldn't even have the desire to do something evil.
Mm-hmm.
Doing actions that are incorrect, those emotions I have to deal with. If I have an emotion to do something evil, but I'm never going to do it, That emotion I don't have to deal with. But where I do an action based on the emotion, I scream at somebody that doesn't deserve screaming at. I left myself. Hey, just a minute, that was unjust. If I scream at my child more than they deserve, or something that's not going to benefit them, then maybe I should have been quiet, but I can control myself, and then I have to correct. That has to be corrected. So that we have the laws of nature. That's, we have so many laws of nature is enough to point it out. But when you reach higher levels and you've undone or practically all your emotions, and maybe you only have one emotion left, it's only a real situation that's going to make you aware that you're making a mistake. So therefore, you need God to put you in that situation to help you bring the emotion to the fore so that you could realize what you have to deal with. Okay? That's why the person on the higher level, God has to relate to him and sometimes put him in a difficult situation to bring a weak emotion that he has to the fore so that he should be able to deal with it. So we don't need God to put us in a situation. He created the laws of nature. That was enough. And for our emotions, we have plenty of cases every day which shows that we're not living a rational life. We're living irrationally, making silly mistakes. We don't even know they're mistakes. Maybe that's why we're learning this one. We're first finding out what a mistake is. You see? So for that, the laws of nature is enough.